Scott Stringer, as well as many other grassroots organizations.
Well, Jabal Bowman, I want to thank you for being with us. In 10 seconds, can you tell us how it is it to campaign on the ground in this area, which has been known as the epicenter of the pandemic, what it means for you? We're talking to you in Yonkers now, where you just did an event.
Absolutely. So it means being safe, so maintaining social distancing, making sure we're wearing masks, but to still be present and engaged and to still be listening to the needs of the people on the ground.
Jamal Bowman, thanks so much for being with us. Former middle school principal running to represent New York's 16th district, challenging 16-term Congress member, House Foreign Affairs Committee Chair Elliot Engel. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by an amazing team on the ground. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio.
And good morning once again, everybody. I am Paul Rowland here from my home in the Montevilla neighborhood in Portland, Oregon. And this is the third Wednesday, so I've got my third Wednesday co-host, Sarah, of Portland Assembly, on the other line, either right now or shortly. Are you there, Sarah?
I am here. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. Well, you know, there's all sorts of things we could talk about. We could talk about, like, how 2020 is on track to be, once again, the hottest year on record. We could talk about the massive diesel oil spill in the Arctic. We could talk about the huge raging wildfires in Arizona. We could also talk about what we've been talking, you and your other co-hosts have been talking a lot about in the How long have we been doing this? Over a year, I think, which is white supremacist roots of the police and the need to potentially abolish the police. And all of a sudden, everybody's talking about it. What's going on?
Well, I mean, as my co-host John and I have been talking about. Police are founded in the white supremacist roots of this nation, and lots and lots of black writers and speakers over the years have indicated that this would be a reckoning that we would have to go through. And I think it's pretty interesting to see that kind of come to a head. Like, we cannot move past a point of dangerous white supremacy in this country while we have police. And it's becoming more and more apparent to people. And then it seems almost as if the police are doubling down and showing us the truth of that in their response. So it's been a busy month.
Indeed, and they just keep shooting black people in the midst of it all.
They seem to be
not only clueless, but oblivious and unable to change. That's for sure.
They're certainly unwilling to change, which honestly has been. I mean, I started out years ago trying to work with Charlie Hales on police accountability, and of course there are people in the city who have been doing it far, far longer than that. And it became apparent to me that accountability is not possible under this structure. even if it weren't for, you know, the massively overfunded and overempowered police unions, they simply don't listen to citizen review boards, citizen oversight boards. They don't take their recommendations. They, you know, have so many structures in place, and it's not even like loopholes, it's structures in place so that police are never held accountable for this. And it's not surprising that they would demonstrate an awareness of this, you know, unchecked power that they really have. And I think the way that they are doing it, it's very interesting to me, because as somebody who has been, you know, reading and studying and listening to folks who live on the margins, it's become pretty clear to me, like a fairly long time back, that the police and the rest of us are at odds. We are enemies. And over the past few weeks, looking at police response, looking at just the things they're saying, their faces out there at night, they know this. They know there are enemies. They know, like, that this is the battle. And it's a very interesting place to be, where, like, people are seeing their kids from the suburbs go out to protest with their high school friends and get attacked by police, and they can't ignore it anymore, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah, there's a lot of aspects to talk about, one of which is something of a generational shift. I started to explore this a couple times on my show. I'd definitely like to do so more with you, because you've been, I think, in contact more directly with people who are both, you know, organizing and participating, possibly. But first, just give me some of your impressions, both, I guess, observing and maybe talking to people in other parts of the country and in Portland itself. What are some of your impressions about how this has been playing out?
Well, it's been really interesting to kind of be able to see what's happening in other cities around the same stuff. And as much as, like, it's been very interesting, actually. I just want to pivot and talk about police response across various cities and their PR machine, mm-hmm. and the way that it kicked into gear, because that's been something. And I think one of the things that is geared to do is, of course, divide protesters. And they've been playing, not just in Portland, but across the country, this good, bad protester narrative, which is false, because we're all out there trying to get the same thing. So to say that, you know, because you are willing to use tactics that other people aren't, like yelling at the police, you are a bad protester and therefore subject to violence. has been something that's been consistent across the board. It's also been really interesting to see them just really roll out that, like, when they all started kneeling, you know,
right,
hundreds of cops kneeling 10 minutes before brutalizing the public. It was odd to me that that got as much traction as it did, both because of the inappropriateness of that particular symbolic action, considering the way that George Floyd was murdered.
I mean, if they had knelt and simultaneously taken off all their armaments and weaponry and you know, put it in a big pile and set it on fire,
burned it. Perhaps that would have been appropriate. As it was, to me, that seemed an almost calculated insult. You know, that they were going to give us this sort of gesture, but that it would be tinged with the same cruelty that the police behavior is always tinged with. It seems pretty consistent. It's also interesting to note the way that, and this is a further operative as far as dividing protesters, is that there have been some sort of, you know, city or publicly endorsed protesters in various cities who have gone and met with city officials and taken it upon themselves to represent the will of the community. And it's interesting because it has been noted by people in various cities that a lot of these people, and this is not to say that people who are new to activism should not, you know, speak out and participate and become a part of this. But when someone is eager to declare themselves the leader of a leaderless movement, one should always be suspicious of their motives. And their motives can be, you know, personal, and that can serve some ends of the state. You know, if our egos are in this, we can be used as tools. And that's something that we have to, you know, consider. But it's been very interesting to watch people say, you know, you when you meet with the police, when you meet with the city, you are not representing us, and to sort of, you know, call this out and try to deal with it in ways that are useful, bringing people into the community, giving them the tools to go forward, but also letting them know that the boundaries of the movement do not include negotiating with police. So that's been a very interesting thing to watch.
Well, called it in your message to me yesterday. Well, you actually called some of these tactics, like kneeling and others, actually counterinsurgency techniques.
Oh, absolutely. They know what they're doing. Even when it comes to, you know, being out there on the street and, you know, 10:30, 11 o'clock, the police start making announcements saying that if you stay, you will be an unlawful protester, right? That you will be, you know, at an unsanctioned gathering, and you will be subject to use of force. So that signals to all the people who, you know, are not maybe, you know, have not been out here doing this for years, that it's time for them to go home. That is nice, upstanding people who follow rules, that they should leave. And we have to remember, when they say those things, that these are the people that were out here protesting who are giving us these orders, who are dividing us into little categories and telling us which ones are doing it right and which aren't. And I think that we just have to remember at all times that they are doing this in a very calculated manner, and it is counterinsurgency. It's interesting because that actually speaks to something else I've been thinking about, which is sort of the cop continuum, the continuum of policing, that goes all the way from, you know, somebody at a protest telling someone else not to touch the fence, oh, that fence, to the way that our troops, you know, overseas control property that we have commandeered, that we have stolen with violence. And it's all the same system. And so we have to recognize our part in that. There's a whole thing where they say, kill the cop in your head. And really, like, for me, that's about authority. but also like putting authority outside of myself. And we've talked about this a lot, actually, just in terms of, you know, mutual aid and community like networks, is that and police abolition, is that we have this concept that we need an authority outside of ourselves, outside of our communities, to come in and tell us what's right and tell us, you know, how to do what we're doing. And I would just want everybody to examine why we think we need that. What is it about somebody having not very much training and a badge and a gun that makes them more capable of handling a crisis than you or me? And I don't think that there's anything inherent in that. I think it's important to question that.
Well, I think it seems like if anything comes out of this, it seems to be that along the lines of what you're saying, is there is a serious, some real moves being made around the country towards, you know, this whole idea of defund the police. I think there's some confusion around it. I mean, at its heart, I mean, it could be all the way to disbanding the police force and, you know, inventing something completely different. But what seems to be happening is people are taking much more seriously what you're saying in terms of various components of the roles of the police, you know, dealing with mental health crises, mm-hmm. dealing with houselessness, dealing with all sorts of aspects of you know, issues, ongoing issues in our communities that the police have basically either arrogated unto themselves or been given license to deal with exclusively. And it seems like there's been disbanding of certain units in the police forces. There have been, you know, moves to create civilian units that deal with some of these things. I think that's really, really significant. And if it can, I think it seems to add, you know, to use a metaphor, fuel to the fire of this growing movement, that people are gaining some of these successes and hopefully going further with them.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even here, we've seen, you know, a rash of people leaving office, quitting their jobs. D.A. Underhill resigned yesterday.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he recommended that Mike Schmidt, the incumbent DA, be put in office as of the 1st of August, which...
This seems to be a small movement happening. There's been mayors resigning, police chiefs resigning, members, you know, numerous members of police forces have been resigning. Interesting.
Beautiful. Time to get new jobs. well, and it is important, like, it's really important to point out and to keep pointing out that defund is the first step, and that I'm. It's great to see people getting on board with it, but that can't be the end of it. Because another thing we have to recognize is that you know, we have other levels of this, and so you know, white supremacy is super malleable, and it will shift into our National Guard. It will shift into our, you know, social work is already rife with white supremacy. So if we, in an unexamined manner, say, let's just replace cops with social workers, then social workers will just become cops. So I think that we want one of these 8-step programs to tell us how to do this, but it's going to be a little more complicated than that. But there are lots of, you know, there's an 8 to abolition graphic that you can find if you just Google 8 to abolition, that's actually really clear about steps, and very helpful as far as, you know, that just we defund, we disarm, and then we disband. And then, you know, we have a lot of other structures in our communities, and we can build a lot of other structures in our communities. Our cities have become life support systems for police departments at this point, economically speaking. So imagine what happens if we funnel all of that back into these community like support systems. I honestly don't even, as somebody who thinks about it a lot, don't even know what it looks like. As far as like that level of funding for these programs, these are things that we... you know, education, like teachers buy their own supplies for their students. We starve these like very important aspects of community life. And then all of that goes into policing. So it'll be really great to see what happens when, you know, our schools and our community centers are better funded than our police.
And of course, then there's the other even bigger rampaging armed elephant in the room that people are actually starting to talk about, because it's you mentioned it yourself when you talked about overseas occupations, is the U.S. military itself, which gobbles up an even vaster share of our precious public resources and hardly even gets discussed. And it seems like there's, I think Barbara Lee just started talking about introducing legislation to cut the Pentagon budget. It seems like even things that were you know, so many things that were unthinkable, you know, a couple of months ago are now becoming topics of at least conversation.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Well, and yeah, police are, and the Army are, we can see that they're very, very closely connected. They have the same culture. They have the same equipment. And we have to recognize that slide will happen if we are not careful. Like, police who are devoted to this way of life will, you know, we got to watch the militia movement at this point, because there's already a lot of crossover in that Venn diagram between white supremacist militia and state and local police. So
yeah, they just shot a somebody trying to take down that statue of the conquistador in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm, in Albuquerque.
Yeah.
And he is the son of a, what, state sheriff? Or a county sheriff? And
oh,
he,
no way. I didn't get to that yet.
Yep, and has been at, you know, has been visible at white supremacist rallies and considers himself part of a militia. So that right there in one story indicates that this is something we've got to watch out for. And, you know, in Oregon, Washington area, we've got some pretty solid problems, and historically speaking, with white supremacist groups. And that is definitely, you know, there'll be militias, there'll be new security companies that'll pop up with weird insignia. I mean, we already have some of those, so I definitely see, like, these dudes getting into private security, which is, of course, pretty consistent, because if you're just trying to protect capital anyway, then you may as well go work directly for the source instead of having the city, you know, have to be the middleman to make it so you can work for Apple, right?
Indeed. Well, I just want to remind people, this is a Wednesday talk radio. I'm your weekly host, Paul Roland, and I have my third Wednesday co-host, Sarah, excuse me, on the line as well. And you can call in and join the conversation at 503-231-8187. Well, I did say I want to talk about this idea of a generational shift, but I want to just follow along with what you're saying. Is there are people who are already talking about and seriously worried about this backlash that, people have seen a lot of movements rise up and then dissipate. You know, bigger, longer lasting, shorter lasting, bigger, smaller, but you know, they tend to have sort of a life cycle. And then at the end, you know, where are the people, especially the most vulnerable people, who are, you know, most at the mercy of the white supremacist backlash? So, what would you say to people who are already concerned about this backlash, you know, happening, as assuming, which maybe one shouldn't assume, that this is going to fade, this moment?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, this sort of thing comes in waves, and one of the reasons we push as hard as we do when we have the momentum of that wave with us is for the protection of the most vulnerable. The more of this that we can really undermine and really like eradicate. I mean, this is the first step in dealing with the issue of white supremacy in this country, as sort of the shock troops of white supremacy, like the police in the United States, protect this structure. And one thing I will say regarding generational shift, like younger people right now are not keeping what does not serve them, and that includes Applebee's and the police. Like, nobody feels like these are necessary institutions because they only protect bad things, you know? The police protect capitalism and white supremacy. And if we, you know, generationally speaking, are deciding we're done with that and that we want to move to a better place, like, the reason that we're still a white supremacist country is because we want to be, you know? It takes will to change that. And I do see that will in, you know, younger generations right now, in like what we call them, Zoomers or whatever. They really are serious about this, like, and they have less fear, I think. There is something beautiful about the sense of humor of this generation, and that they really will just laugh in a cop's face. But they're also very angry about it. They don't want, you know, to have to live like this anymore, and they are ready to change it. And I think that this is a beautiful momentum, and if we can keep it up, we can do a lot. So
we have a caller.
Oh yeah, we have a caller. But I definitely do. Yeah, see, an intense generational like push. From, you know, people under 30, people under 20, to really get this handled. They don't want to deal with this anymore. So,
well, all I can say is it's about damn time. Anyway, let's go to our first caller. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Camilo.
Good morning. Hello. I want to discuss an idea that will give police accountability some real teeth, a concrete proposal for a plan that would hold police financially responsible. The origin of the idea comes from the discussion of requiring corporations to post bonds in the event that they did some polluting activity which they didn't take responsibility for. There would be a fund that'd be available to do the cleanup so that it wouldn't be shifted onto the city. And I think the same thing should be true for the police. And it could be a requirement of their contract and part of the budget process for the police. That would be that the police would have to post a bond, which in the event of a settlement of unjustified force and harm made by the court, that the police would be responsible for paying it, not the city. Why should the taxpayers be paying for the harm that's done by this one specific group of people? In the way that this is set up, there is a budget item to pay for settlements in the police, and it's up to a certain quantity, of course. And above that, there is a insurance policy for any settlements that go above what is available in the budget. And as a result of that, insurance agencies have a certain amount of influence over the police that they can insist on, you know, the bad apples being taken out of the barrel in order to reduce their costs. So what this accountability would do, it would make the police financially responsible for the harm that they do, taking it away from the socialization into the public sector. And it would do something which I think would make them more judicious in the way that they behave, and it would probably also encourage them to allow professionals, mental health professionals, to answer those specific calls where there's a mental health crisis. They would probably be grateful to be relieved of that risky situation. So I don't know exactly what the legal status of this is, but I think it's something that we should be talking about, and particularly now when the legislature is coming back to answer questions of accountability and the police budget is under review.
Thank you. So I'm going to say, as somebody who has done a fair amount of work pushing for police reform and police accountability, that is something that has been on the table for years. It has been proposed by many individuals and citizen oversight boards over the years. And this is one of the reasons we have come to this point is because the police themselves are proving that accountability is not something that they will submit themselves to, and that reform is not something they are willing to do. I don't know that our citizen review boards or citizen oversight boards have ever had a recommendation adopted by our police. The unions are so powerful at this point that even in places, one of the things that I have noticed, and there was a reform package put out at sort of at the beginning of this, and the 8 steps to abolition was a response to it. And it was a set of reformist suggestions based on metrics, things like banning chokeholds and whatnot. Now, I am going to tell you that even in cities where chokeholds are already banned, police find ways to kill people. In cities where excessive use of force is already supposed to come with these repercussions, police are excused and reinstated and rehired constantly. These reforms that have already been put in place do not work.
Well, that's the reason I'm suggesting this, because this is going to hit them in the pocketbook, and we know that it's money that really makes the difference in
sure, but you're not the first person to suggest this. Like, this has been something that's been on the
table. Well, it doesn't matter who's the first or who's the last. The question is, it's appropriate for this particular moment, and we need to think about how we can implement it. So it's a matter of the value and the relevance and the efficiency of the idea and what we need to do in order to get behind it. There's no reason for coming up with a lot of excuses why, you know, this can't be done, but let's look how it can be done.
Well, I mean, I would also say that that does not actually bring anybody back after they've
been. Of course it doesn't bring anybody back. We're trying to prevent this from happening in the future. So let's see what is required. Is it state legislation? Is it an amendment to the budget? Is it a negotiation with the union to get this established? And let's impose it. Let's retake the power from the police union and put it in the hands of the people and not allow them to shift the burden onto the public any longer.
Okay, well, it's on the table, and I hope people get it, you know, take it further. I hope you take it further. And thanks for calling and bringing that up. That's a good point. So 503-231-8187 is the number to call in, like Camilo just did. And we're got about half an hour left. I'm Paul Rowland. I'm with Sarah with Portland Assembly on the third Wednesday. It sounds like there's a difference, you know, in strategy and possibly philosophy or politics behind your difference with Camille on that, you being more of a abolitionist, Sarah, I believe, thinking that, you know,
in my Twitter bio, I am an abolitionist, yes.
Okay, and so, yeah, so these are things that need to be, you know, these are differences that are going to keep reappearing, differences in strategy and difference in politics.
I would also say, though, that, like, this is, so the study of abolition and the study of police reform goes back centuries. Like, Ida B. Wells was writing reports on this, on lynchings in the South and police involvement, you know, 150, 200 years ago. So these reforms that people push for, we've been trying, people have been trying to implement reforms forever. I would say that that is probably one of the highest like points of burnout for community work, is people trying to get any sort of accountability from the police. Like, you know, we see even just in the communities of families of those killed by the police, we see, you know, years long, you know, we travel through, you know, community and civil courts, we, you know, see these people try to get some justice or even just information about their murdered loved ones, and it doesn't happen. We see, like, that I appreciate that people want to, you know, try to fix this, but when something is so resistant, like, the police union exists primarily to protect cops who do bad things in their communities. I don't really understand why it would change at this point, you know?
Well, the other thing is, you're talking about a battle that would have to be basically fought on a you know, municipality by municipality basis, or state by state, or, you know, whatever jurisdiction, you know, I'm sure there's people who, maybe you would be able to immediately think at what jurisdictional level that would play out. But that's certainly not a comprehensive solution. Of course, you know, abolishing the police is the same thing, unless you're, you know, in a truly revolutionary situation where you've actually, you know, depending on your ideological perspective, taken over the nation state apparatus or dissolved the nation state apparatus. But obviously we're so far from there. But I guess my point is, I would, you know, from my experience as an activist and reading about the way reform efforts have failed and across a lot of struggles, like, you know, basically, you know, strip mining or you know, clear cutting, or, well, in this case, police shootings. I mean, I hate to put these all on the same level, but in some senses they're all similar, in the sense that you're trying to, you know, change some sort of fundamental aspect of the way power works in society, in terms of abusing, you know, people and animals and nature. And people tend to focus on one strategy that, if you look at it, it's you can kind of see how it's going to go. You know, I hate to say that Camilo's strategy is a losing strategy, but it's an awesome task to look at, you know, fighting every police force across the nation to try to get that, you know, that change in the way that, you know, the way that kind of police are held financially responsible for the damage and death they cause to people. And, you know, I've seen it across movements, that movements die when they choose a strategy that ends up,
sure,
all the resources end up being put in that one strategy. And like you said, it's just burnout. I mean, sure, if somebody, you know, if a group of people decides that that's the strategy they want to, you know, to take in their particular area, and they think they're able to be successful, and they are, then, you know, kudos to them. But is it really the way to really deal with the situation, the problem, that the origin of the problem?
Well, and I say do all the things, right? Like, we should be defunding. That's a great place to start. We should be, you know, if you want to sue the cops in your area, I am all for it. If you want to go up against the police union, like, do all the things. Literally, they are killing us. We have got to get this dealt with. And, you know, any blow against the edifice of white supremacy is a blow. So I would never discourage anybody from, you know, taking more incremental, you know, steps, but it's not for me. For me, like, driving at the heart of the problem is what I focus on. So that's not to say that, you know, trimming away at the edges of the cancer isn't also helpful.
Right? There's Robbie on the line.
Okay, well, let's go quickly to Robbie. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. I love the conversation you all are having. I got to agree with Sarah. I don't think reform does anything. If you read any activists from Angela Davis or, you know, I think even Malcolm X back in the civil rights era, all of them knew, well, they saw what happened, and it's the Democrats, the liberals, they fall victim to getting these breadcrumbs, and then they're the ones that have the support. Right now, you know, we have thousands of people every night coming out and marching in support of this, so it's not going away. So we got to take this momentum and go straight to the root cause, which is the systemic racism that's involved with this. And we got to tell, you know, these liberal Democratic people, I'm not against them at all. And for the most part, you know, I am considered one. But I watch how the Democratic Party and the establishment take advantage of these situations to, you know, give us some breadcrumbs, you know, take a meal with the police officer, and then, you know, everything's going to
so
be fine.
Susceptible.
What was that?
I just said they're so susceptible.
Oh, it's amazing watching what they're doing right now. Actually, they are extremely efficient in trying to shunt or, you know, sabotage
these
movements.
Neutralize.
That's what the goal is, I guess. But so watching this go down, I just wanted to say, you know, a lot of times when this topic gets brought up, we really need to be able to educate the people who are, and I don't mean in a bad way, but just inform them of what it is, these views, what we see when we talk about, you know, disbanding the police or getting rid of police, you know. And a lot of people, I hear them all the time, they're like, well, you know, that sounds scary, you know, like who's going to protect us from stuff? And that's already coming from a place of privilege, because I had the talk when I was growing up. You know, I lived in a heavily Latino community in Arizona, and I myself am Mexican. And what I was given the talk is, you know, don't call police. You know, you want to call a parent first. You know, don't call police. Because in my community, there was a Mexican kid wearing some baggy pants. I guess the police showed up. He went to pick up his pants, and they shot and killed him. And so, you know, I was, you know, and that was at a young age. And so, like, yeah. I don't think, you know, white families really understand that, you know, it's not safe for everybody to call the police. So I think that's what we need to be instilling, that along with the fact that when you have a person with a badge and a gun responding, you know, and here's the weird thing is, like, these police unions, you know, I am skeptical of you know, listening to what reforms it is that they want, but in order to get something done, you know, I think that it is it's worthwhile to listen, because there are police unions that are coming out, and they're, you know, they said, look, you know, 90% of the calls we get, we're not, you know, they need social workers. They need, you know, people who are trained in psychology to deal with these calls. And instead, we're sending, you know, a militarized, you know, guy with the police, you know, with a badge and a gun. And so it's like we need to tell people, like, that's what we mean by, you know, disbanding the police. Let's send first responders without guns, you know, wellness checks. Why have so many black and brown people died for a wellness check, you know?
I gotta say, it's nice when the cops come with that sort of suggestion, but I'm also going to say that they are the ones who are asking for, you know, $80 million increases to their budget. So where is that money for community care coming from?
Like, right, yeah. And they're gonna point to their tank or their rocket launcher and be like, yeah. You know, so. Anyway, I just wanted to share those points, but thank you very much for the conversation, and, you know, I really do look forward to this movement that we have. I just hope it doesn't fizzle out and, you know, succumb to, I don't know, Joe Biden's request or Kamala Harris, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well,
thanks for calling, Robbie. Always good to hear from you. So one thing I know you wanted to talk about, Sarah, well, you want to continue on that. I know you wanted to talk about the targeting and attacking the press. There's been hundreds of incidents around the country, including right here in Portland. But if you want to continue off on what Robbie was saying first.
Yeah, just one thing that hit me. He was mentioning, or they were mentioning that, you know, one of our biggest issues is, you know, sort of neoliberal centrist Democrats who are just as tied to the status quo as anybody else because they make money off of it. So they don't want to end policing. And they are very good at sort of pulling the people who might be looking for new ways back into the fold. And that's a lot of the sort of, you know, cops kneeling stuff that we've seen. But one of the things that I think is interesting is that even here in Portland, you know, leftist, green, liberal Portland, with our lefty city commissioners and whatnot, they're still not voting the will of the people, right? We had thousands and thousands and thousands of people give testimony. And I listened to a lot of it, and I did not hear anybody who was not a city commissioner say that they supported more funding for the police. Literally every person that called in to give testimony called for at least defunding the police by $50 million per year. Which is
this is a recent city council session?
Last week, yes.
Uh-huh.
And then they used some bureaucratic ploys to postpone the vote. So they are, I think, supposed to be voting on it again today or taking more testimony, but they may now be delaying the vote until fall. I'm not entirely sure. But what that does is default us back to the old budget, right? So we're not defunding anything. We're not moving forward. We're not doing what people have been very clearly asking for. We're reverting to the status quo, and they're going to use, you know, excuses about political infighting and bureaucratic restrictions, some of which aren't actually true, to sort of justify their lack of action on this.
Well, maybe someone knows more about the actual status of the city council process on this and wants to call 503-231-8187. We have less than 15 minutes left. Ty, do we have anyone else on the line?
Yes, we have Sean on the line.
Okay, let's hear what Sean has to say. Go ahead.
Good morning. You know, one of my favorite sayings is when the elephants fight, the grass suffers. And what I take that to mean is that the people that run everything, you know, the capitalist class, the 1%, they don't even take us into consideration. Our lives are afterthoughts to them. And in the wake of the George Floyd murder and the demonstrations, you know, against systemic racism, I was wondering, in your opinion, do you think it's desirable or do you think it will be possible that we go from an analysis of systemic racism to a dehumanizing and utterly parasitic analysis of the capitalist system? Would you say that's like class reductionism if we included a Marxist analysis of capitalist society in general? Or do you think it's important to keep the focus on systemic racism? And I'll stop there.
Well, thanks. Do you see those two as being separate? Sean, yourself?
So I guess I would fall into the camp of the folks like Adolf Reed Jr. and his son Torrey Reed, who kind of get accused of being class reductionist. Like DSA recently canceled Adolf Reed Jr.'s lecture a couple weeks ago. It just seems logical to me that we have to include this focus on a dehumanizing parasitic system. You know, like
do you see them as being separate?
So I'm very conflicted because I thought the uprising in the wake of the Trump corporate tax cut and the CARES Act that transferred $6 trillion to the wealthiest people in the world, I thought that was going to lead to a proletarian uprising. And that's not what we're seeing. We're seeing an analysis of systemic racism. So
we're seeing an uprising. Are you against it?
Oh, of course not.
Okay.
I mean, on the one hand, it's very uplifting, but is this, like, Caleb Maupin he's a, you know, respected Marxist author. He's come out and basically said more or less that, like, you know, this is taking away analysis of the capitalist system, and, you know, it's like a Trump reelection campaign, basically.
Well, let's let Sarah have a go at it. Go ahead, Sarah.
Okay, thanks.
Well, okay, so Walter Rodney, who is an African academic, Walter Rodney, who is an African academic, in a book called How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, which, if you haven't read, it's a really, really good sort of foundation for how our current capitalist system was developed. And one of the things that he talks about is how white supremacy, capitalism, and patriarchy are intrinsically entwined. They are braided oppressions, is what he calls them. And I think that that is absolutely true. I do not think that we can address one without addressing the other. I think that the reason that sort of Marxist analysis first tends to fail is because it does not, it's not intersectional. It doesn't include, like, you can't put your particular concern first. They all go together. And I think that that is something that is actually maybe more inherently recognized by this sort of younger, like, activist group that's coming up. Not particular group, but like this age group that's coming into the movement now, is that they do know that this is all together. Like, there's a phrase that I like: this is nice stuff for everyone. And that, to me, like, is about as Marxian as I need to get in it, because what we're talking about is access, and that access is delineated by your color and your gender, right? And how you present in the world. So if the only way that we can access that is by being, you know, a cis straight white male, then we got to knock that down. And that's what's happening, basically.
And I think it's interesting that the, I don't know, I just, I'm kind of conflicted about the whole move towards, you know, removing statues as being potentially sort of a fetishizing, sort of reducing the struggle to sort of a symbolic level. On the other hand, I think it's kind of kick-ass that that people are tearing down these visible reminders, you know, in-your-face reminders of what you're talking about, you know, the origins of this, you know, the latest, one of the latest ones, which we mentioned, that somebody was shot over, which obviously shows that these white supremacist militias are taking it very seriously. The Juan de Oñate, the conquistador, colonizer in Albuquerque, and then there's a number of Columbus statues. There's statues of King Leopold in Belgium. One has actually been taken down. One was surrounded by African immigrants who obviously take it very seriously and personally that King Leopold, you know, slaughtered hundreds of thousands or however many Congolese. I don't know. I think it's a fascinating moment that people there is an intersectionality in the movement very, very visibly.
I mean, I think that, I don't know, imagine being black and going to school under the name of a slave owner. Like, I would love to tear that down, you know? I feel like...
Well, yeah, they did tear down a statue of Jefferson at Jefferson High School. That's true.
They did. And imagine that. I think some of that is a recognition that symbols are important. And that they mean stuff, and that it's also kind of a celebration, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a victory, and it's a visible indication of that victory. You know, and I think that's important to claim, especially if it's done by people who have lived under the eye of that statue for years. You know. I love it. I'm all for it.
Well, listen, we only have about 5 minutes left. I want to check in real quick with Ty to see if we have a last caller. Ty, is there anybody else?
We do. Ruth is on the line.
Okay, go ahead, Ruth.
Thanks, guys. worldwide, really, racism is systemic. However, I think capitalism is the reason it gets to be shoved on all of us if we look at everybody's history. And just like you said earlier, you know, looking at it like a cancer is use a lot of different strategies to say to the cancer, we're done with this. Not just keep gnawing at it, but letting it know we're done with it. So whatever youth are leading us, and that's cool. Yeah, the symbols, get rid of them. Thanks for your show, but I think we're not readers as a society. We need to look at our history and say people running the capitalist, they know their turf is eroding, and we just have to bring that to them in whatever way we can. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ruth.
Thank you.
So we'll just let that stand. That's a very well-taken point that stands on its own. I did want to, Sarah, let you talk about, because I know you have a good friend who was a press victim of police violence. Just, I want you to, you did want to talk some about that, and it's happening all around the country. It seems to be a clearly strategic counterinsurgency tactic as well.
Yeah, and that's what one of the things I mean. Like, the police are real bold right now. Like, they're really like, we accuse them of brutality, and they get out there and really show us on camera how they're going to brutalize us. And yeah, they're not leaving press out of this at all. It looks like, you know, the Willamette Week and the Mercury have had people out. They have all, I think, had unpleasant interactions with cops that at least included getting tear gas, whether or not they were holding up their press passes. You know, Corey Elia, who does a podcast with Cable, has been got sprayed right in the face, point blank, and then also was beat up pretty bad the other night. And this is all on camera. They're saying out loud in words that they don't care about people's press passes, that they don't care about First Amendment rights. So, like,
and one of the early images of this whole uprising was a black CNN reporter arrested on camera by the police, and then there's been an Australian camera crew was brutalized, and they've got there's been three countries actually have formal complaints against the United States. I mean, this is the kind of thing that, you know, the United States sort of, you know, was sort of congratulate itself on in always, you know, calling out violations of press freedom around the world. It's kind of shocking, although I guess predictable, but does show the intensity of the moment, though.
Well, and I also, like, honestly, it doesn't really matter if they're doing it out of ignorance or just blatant, like, not caring about following the actual law, because it could be a mix of both, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's been very intense. It seems... I mean, even to the point that there was they do little videos every night, and one of their officers, like, tells us things or whatever, and one of them, basically, they said that they would not be respecting the press. That she said, press needed to be out of the area as well. I'm sure it was a gaffe, but that she said that press would also be subject to the unlawful orders.
Listen, we got a minute left. I hate to do like Amy Goodman does. In 30 seconds, where do you see all this going? People are now talking about this is a movement. How do we make this a movement? How do we keep the, you know, it's, I guess no one can really predict.
I mean, I am of the opinion that that unless we abolish police, this cannot be a safe place for non-white people to live, for black and non-white people to live. And I think that if we have decided that we want to have a safe place for people, then, or a safer place for people, then we've got to do this. So I hope that this will end with an abolition of the police and a reinvestment in community networks of support, and things like free housing, which would be intrinsic to a healthy community, and access to medical care and mental health care for people. And that seems like stuff we could start funding if we didn't have to worry about buying great big tanks for the police to terrorize us within our communities.
And stop buying tanks for the military. Defund the military. That's my last word. Okay,
yeah,
well, thanks as always, Sarah.
Either.
Great to talk to you. Talk to you again in a month, probably. We'll see.
All right.
And stay tuned for more great programming here on KBOO Community Radio.
Thanks so much. Talk to you soon, Paul. Have a good one.
Okay, bye, Sarah.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:58 a.m.
This is KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
This week on Making Contact. On May 25th, 2020, the nation ignited after a bystander posted a horrific video of Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin kneeling on George Floyd's neck for over 8 minutes. As terrible as Floyd's death was, it was the final straw in the most recent series of killings by police, retired or on duty, against African